This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later on today's show, the evolution of the TV sitcom. But first, you've more than likely experienced a few of these. You walk into a room and you forget why you're there, not remembering where you left your car keys or your cell phone, or you draw a blank on a person's name. It's fairly common to have memory lapses like these, but they can be troubling. And joining us to discuss what we can do to keep our brains healthy and help prevent or reduce future cognitive decline are the Bob and Sandy Hyman Chair in Research and Education of Alzheimer's Disease and Medical Director of the Memory Disorders Center at the University of Cincinnati Neuroscience Institute, Dr. Rana Schatz, and Professor of Clinical Psychiatry and Director of the Cognitive Aging Program at the UC College of Medicine, Dr. Robert Krikorian. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Ron and Robert, thank you so much for being here this afternoon.
Pleasure.
You're welcome.
You know, Rana, how much can we actually do in terms of preventive care for our brains? Can you actually, can a disease like dementia or Alzheimer's, can those actually be prevented?
Yes, you know, I think that's one of the most exciting ideas that has come up over the last 20, 30 years of research. And in a way, it shouldn't be surprising. We've learned this from every other disorder, like heart disease, when we would only intervene when somebody had a failed heart. Well, we were so focused on a failed brain. Now we know that the brain is something that can be supported like every other organ in our body. I think the ideas of prevention are extremely key, and that also means some challenges to us as a society, because I think we've still have a stigma with it. So the idea that we should know more about what's going on in our brain a couple decades before anything happens in terms of a symptom, it can be pretty scary. But that is where we're going. We need to start early.
Mm, Robert, your thoughts?
Yes, I agree totally. It's pretty clear now that your health in midlife predicts your health in late life, and that includes your risk for dementia. So in middle age, people should be aware of this, because people do live into old age and in our culture, and they should work at preserving their health in midlife and into late life. And there are actually some Alzheimer's prevention clinics in the country now. I happen to consult to one that's at Cornell Medical Center in New York City. There are, I think, three others, perhaps more at this point. And in terms of the research we do, we have shifted from conditions in old age that increase risk for dementia to a midlife, age 50 to 65, middle age epoch, and trying to introduce interventions at that point to see if we can improve memory function and ultimately reduce risk.
You're talking about risk. What were some of the risk factors for dementia?
There were many. the metabolic problems like insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes, and the associated cardiovascular factors like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, all of those sorts of things, the diseases of aging or diseases of civilization, all of those increase risk for late life dementia, in addition to things like family history and other factors.
I think also one that is emerging as extremely important is sleep. And we forget about this, that a third of our lives are spent in this, and it makes sense that it should have been important and we should have thought of it as something that had a relationship to brain function. And it turns out that poor sleep, whether it's due to a sleep disorder like apnea, rapid eye movement, or periodic leg movements of sleep, or just the fact that Western societies have a TV in the bedroom and that interferes with sleep, those are risk factors as well. And so we spend a lot of time counseling, coaching, investigating sleep issues. So I would say that also is something emerging. And that comes from the fact that sleep is the time when the brain does some toxic waste management. And if you miss out on that sleep and don't reach that sleep stage where that occurs, you're not able to do the normal house cleaning. that you need to on a daily basis.
So you're really doing your brain health a huge favor if you focus on quality sleep.
Exactly. It shouldn't be something you should feel macho about if you only get 4 or 5 hours.
Is genetics a large factor? If you have a family history of Alzheimer's, dementia, how concerned should you be?
Genetics risk is a factor. It's less important in what we consider to be late life dementia, that is dementia occurring at approximately age 65 and older. And it's more of an issue for people who have the onset of dementia earlier in life. And then the family history is also independent of genetics is somewhat of a risk factor as well, especially maternal. If one's mother and, say, maternal grandparent had late-life dementia, that would be perceived as a risk as well.
But just because it runs in your family doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to develop it later.
Right. I would say that's true in the sense that people understand genes. If you have a gene, you get it. But I would say we actually look at genetics a little differently as a potential of targeting for this personalized prevention program. Alzheimer's comes about through a number of different pathways, and there are a number of genes that we call risk genes now. And knowing which risk genes you have can help us determine which of a number of prevention strategies are most important for you. And we kind of know big categories of how these fall. We know that there's a group of inflammatory genes that can increase or decrease your risk. We know that there's amyloid processing genes that can increase or decrease your risk and other transport kinds of genes. And so by hopefully soon that genetic profiling that we have some technology for but are not quite there in terms of how to manage it, but that's going to probably be a big component of how we personalize these preventions.
Should your mental acuity be something that's looked at in a physical exam year to year?
Oh, you mean cognitive?
Yeah, cognitive.
I think I'm quite in favor of that. I feel like just like we get our cholesterol and blood pressure, why shouldn't we think of our brain as important? But I want to emphasize what you said earlier, that the idea that you don't necessarily have symptoms when your brain is already in early stages of decline. So yes, we want to monitor it. I think comparing a person to themselves is probably going to, in the end, turn out to be more sensitive than what we do now, which is compare you to a large group.
So in other words, a doctor could get a baseline,
exactly.
I guess they would call it, and then check you year after year and see if there are any changes in that baseline.
Some of us are really in favor of having, age 50 annual checks. And if you start to see a trend, that really means a really big push in terms of looking at what your risk factors are. And at some point, I'm sure the treatments would be then.
Rana, you're using something called, I believe it's Toolbox.
Yes.
Explain that to us.
Okay. This is, and actually, you're using it too, yes.
So Rana and Robert, you're both using the Toolbox.
Yeah.
Okay.
What's nice about it is it's easy to administer. It's kind of fun. It's all pictures. And it helps us sample some of the most early and vulnerable parts of our brain. So if we begin to see changes, we have this kind of a tool that is automated. It has infinite number of, many, many different variations. So from year to year, we can use it. We're not worried that somebody's learning the items. Like I hear people practicing MMSE questions in the lobby before they come in, so they get them right. And we have it. It can be done so quickly in 20, 30 minutes. Yes.
513-419-7100 if you would like to join our conversation. Is there a risk in just not being intellectually active, not reading, not engaging people in conversation? Is that a risk factor as well for developing cognitive problems?
And I think a context maybe to help understand this idea is looking at the brain at what it actually is. I kind of conceptualize it as a survival tool. And this survival tool has undergone many, many years of evolution, and it's learned that certain things are important to pay attention to and other things it can let be. Basically saying that if there's something we know already, the brain doesn't wake up and it doesn't turn all its energies to that. But if there's something new that we encounter, this signals our brain, well, this could be a potential danger or this could be a potential benefit. And it then starts to generate new stem cells, neurons from stem cells, and other processes. So basically, what we're really saying in intellectually engaging, demanding activities, we're saying do things that wake up your brain. They should be novel things. They should be things that either you have this idea in your head, oh, aha moments, things put together, or wow, I never knew that before. So it can be all kinds of things, but it's this feeding the brain's survival kind of purpose.
Sounds like you're saying challenge your brain every
exactly,
now and then.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Robert, what about a lot of us have these occasional memory lapses? Mm-hmm. You know, you forget your keys, you forget your cell phone. When do they cross the line from being something that's normal to being something that you should be concerned about?
Well, I guess generally speaking, it depends on the context in which they occur and how frequently they occur. If they start happening routinely and they're disruptive to your functioning, that is, you're less effective or efficient in your everyday activities because you can't remember what an appointment or you're misplacing items and things like that, or losing your way while driving, things like that, then I think there's a basis for making an appointment with someone to have some sort of an evaluation. Another way to gauge the seriousness of these is to talk to people who are close to you, like a spouse or children, adult children, or close friends who know you well, and they can at times give you some perspective on how meaningful these kinds of problems are.
So you could ask somebody in your family, do I seem more forgetful to
yes.
you?
Yes.
Do I seem like I'm slipping up mentally more often than I
yeah.
used to?
So someone in your family should have a long experience with you and be able to make a judgment about that, typically.
And even though we call these senior moments, mm-hmm. Rhonda, they really can happen at pretty much any age, can't they?
Yeah, and I think I would make the case that if you notice a change in your thinking, no matter how it impacts your daily activity, if that, what we call meta-memory awareness, that memory is not as good, is now has a term associated with it. It's called subjective cognitive impairment. And it really is some feedback from your brain that things are changing. So it doesn't mean you have Alzheimer's, let me just put it that way, but it means that there is something not quite right. And it could be a sleep issue. It could be a medicine you're taking. It could be a dietary issue. It could be a new, your blood sugar's rising.
You could be under a lot of stress.
You could be under, too much stress. So I would say pay attention to anything that you think is different about your thinking. It means something. And all those things turn out to be long-term untreated, the risk factors for Alzheimer's.
We will continue our conversation about keeping your mind sharp and healthy, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, and joining us to discuss what we can do to keep our brains healthy and help prevent or reduce future cognitive decline are the Bob and Sandy Hyman Chair in Research and Education of Alzheimer's Disease and Medical Director of the Memory Disorders Center at the University of Cincinnati Neuroscience Institute, Dr. Rhonda Schatz, and Professor of Clinical Psychiatry and Director of the Cognitive Aging Program at the UC College of Medicine, Dr. Robert Krikorian. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Before we start talking about advice for keeping your mind sharp, I had one other question related to what we were talking to prior to this. What if you do notice a spouse or a friend seems to be becoming more forgetful? Mm-hmm. How do you broach that subject without being insulting? Is there an easy way to do that?
Well, there may not be an easy way, but there's a way that with all kinds of issues like this, is as long as I think you demonstrate caring and understanding, it doesn't have to be confrontational in a negative way, that expressing concern that it seems as if such and such has been happening more frequently lately. I wonder if we could talk about it. And that sort of opening should enhance communication, I think.
And then can we talk about it? I think that's a good question, because then you're leaving it up to them at that point.
Yeah.
And I would say another thing, because what's behind it is the worry that I have something that has no cure, and all it does is open for me this path that I don't want to go on. But if you can bring up the idea that, you know, now, if we intervene at the earliest, we have much more power. Mm-hmm. And many things are not Alzheimer's. And I want to emphasize, we used to think we were pretty good at that. And now we have found with clinical drug trials that almost half in some cases of the people entered into studies did not have Alzheimer's. So clearly there were other things. And we want to give everybody that opportunity of being able to find out the things that are happening and keep them healthy. So I would look at it as saying, don't think that you're going down a path of no return if you look into it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some ways to keep our minds sharp. How important is diet?
Robert.
I think it's the most important factor, certainly not the only, as we've mentioned. And the focus of my research is on nutrition, and in a sense, I think of it as, in terms of advice for people, is knowing what to eat, but also, perhaps more importantly, knowing what not to eat, what to avoid, especially in cultures like ours, which you can characterize as Western cultures, where we consume the Western diet. Many of the diseases of aging occur in Western cultures, but not in other cultures where they don't consume the Western foods, and that's some evidence that that this kind of diet is a factor in late life problems, including Alzheimer's disease.
Now, I've heard Mediterranean diet's a good diet for brain.
Mediterranean diet. There are actually even you may have heard of the Paleolithic diet. There have been a couple of controlled trials with the Paleolithic diet as compared to the Mediterranean, and it's apparently at least as good and potentially better. One of the major factors is the pervasiveness of the high glycemic, low fiber, low nutrition foods in our culture. That is, sweet foods, often mixed with fat, but sometimes not, that have no fiber and don't provide much in the way of nutrition in terms of vitamins and minerals or micronutrients. Our bodies metabolize that kind of food in a way that's abnormal and leads to a lot of the pathologies that we've talked about in terms of insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes. Can affect sleep, can affect blood pressure and other things, and also directly affects how the brain functions over the longer term and risk for Alzheimer's.
Let's talk to Merrill. And if you'd like to join us, the number again, 513-419-7100. Hi, Merrill.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
This question is for Robert. I'm wondering if frequent memorization lowers the risk, and if there is evidence for that, how strong is the evidence?
I'm not sure, actually, if there's evidence that frequent memorizing would lower risk. But it, as Dr. Schatz was mentioning earlier, it seems like a strategy that should be beneficial in terms of challenging your brain. And maybe if you could practice memorizing new things that are unusual to you, items that you don't encounter frequently, or names of things that you don't encounter frequently. That might be helpful as well.
Talk to Nancy in Northern Kentucky. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
My question was, how is your cognitive functioning affected by things like depression or restless leg syndrome, and also the medications that are used? Do the medications have some impact, like antidepressants or L-DOPA or Parkinson's medications that are used for restless leg syndrome?
Okay. Rana?
That's a very good question. I think it's the type of antidepressant. There's actually good evidence that some of the antidepressants actually promote neurogenesis, the growth of new cells, and that's part of their function in improving mood, is that it also works on the memory system. So the ones like you, I think you mentioned what are called SSRIs. I don't know if you said that. But that group is a good one. I think the idea of L-DOPA, there isn't really a direct relationship to memory or risk. The fragmented sleep from restless legs definitely is something that needs to be addressed. I know that the L-DOPA drugs are one of the groups of them used. So it doesn't appear to have either a good or bad, except that if it helps sleep consolidation, that's important.
Let's talk to Jane in the East Side. Hi, Jane.
Hi. My question is having to do with statin drugs and whether or not you feel there is possibly a negative effect on memory, especially short-term memory. I'm a little concerned about that, and I wondered what you might have to say about that.
I think that's a very frequently asked question. This was all based on a 2012 ruling by FDA based on 60 case reports of people self-reporting issues. And since then, there have been large studies where that was looked at with follow-up, and there was absolutely no evidence that statins reduce memory. And if anything, they appear to be protective against the risk of Alzheimer's. That may have something to do specifically with their cholesterol-lowering effect, but actually the statins have another benefit that highly anti-inflammatory. And we know inflammation is one of the earliest changes in the brain related to Alzheimer's. So I tell people, don't hesitate to take the statins and don't go off of them thinking that's the cause of your memory loss.
Okay. Cindy in Loveland joins us now. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. My question is, if you are currently a third shift worker or have ever been a third shift worker, are you... and its effect on sleep, are you automatically predisposed to some of the conditions you're talking about in later life?
Well, I wouldn't say automatically, but it is, you know, depending on how long you didn't sleep at night and had to sleep during the day, how much calendar time you were involved in that sort of activity, that could influence your risk. It's certainly not the way we normally function. You know, our every biological process in the body is tuned to the day-night cycle, and even including the time we eat, and especially the time we sleep, of course. So aligning your everyday activities with the sun, in a sense, and the sun in the dark is important and would tend to lower risk, all things being equal.
Joe in Dayton has a question about I believe it's about the relationship between hearing loss and dementia. Joe?
Hi. I was calling because when my husband got new hearing aids and we were researching about stuff like that, he pointed out to me some of the newer research that shows that untreated hearing loss can contribute significantly to dementia, and not just because of like the lack of social structures when that happens, but actual changes in the brain. And I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Sure. Yes, actually, that's true. And I think it might be helpful to kind of know that the system that's most affected by Alzheimer's disease is a sensory processing system. So it is the system that has antennas up all the time. All our senses feed into memory. If you lose one major pathway towards that memory processing, you're missing out on something that can strengthen memory. So that is perhaps one way of understanding that. We don't understand all of that, but we do know if your eyes are bad, your ears are bad, do whatever you can to enhance that.
Will in Northern Kentucky joins us. Hi, Will.
Yes, doctors, you spoke about nutrition. It's one thing I'm kind of into. So what specifically, I know you got into the diet just as I was calling in, a paleolithic diet and all that. What about DHA supplements? Okay, and the other thing is you mentioned, both of you, about learning something new. So if I don't do, for instance, jigsaw puzzles, I've heard they're good for the brain, will that help me? Or, you know, how far do I have to go about trying to learn something new? So it's, I'm sorry, there's two issues here that I'm sort of confused about.
If you don't eat any cold water fish or fish that have higher levels of omega-3 fatty acids, you probably should supplement. But it's not clear to me that the evidence supports supplementation alone as being effective in terms of whatever protection omega-3s would provide. So it would be a good idea, I think, to take fish with omega-3 fatty acids at least a couple of times a week, and potentially even supplement on top of that. And it's possible to measure levels in your red blood cells to gauge that. In terms of novel activities, it doesn't have to be jigsaw puzzles or crosswords, a variety of things. I think what Dr. Schatz was trying to get across is that exposing yourself to some things that are new and potentially challenging, or to think about things or behave in a different way, is going to activate your brain in a positive way, leading to new learning and helping to maintain your facilities to learn and remember things.
And let's talk to Chelsea in Blue Ash. Hello, Chelsea.
Hi, I've got two quick questions. The first one is, do you think that damage done earlier in your life, for example, I am in my 20s, is reversible? I spent a lot of sleepless nights in college studying, and sometimes I feel that it has inflicted permanent damage on me. And I'm just wondering if you think that the damage is permanent, or is this something that could be reversed?
Well, I think the good news is actually our brain is really plastic. And the younger you are, the more that you have that capacity. So I don't want anyone to feel like, oh my God, I did something, I will never be able to recover. I would say I wouldn't worry so much that it's done permanent damage, but I definitely would look at ways, even in college, to better structure you're studying, and I will tell you, if you get your full night's sleep, you're going to have score better on that test the next day.
Chelsea, do you have another question?
Yeah, my other question was, at least from what I've seen, it seems like a lot of drugs are maybe overused and or misused, especially in elderly patients who live in nursing homes. That's just been my personal experience, particularly with my grandparents. But can you speak to that at all? And is there anything that we can do to encourage our society to maybe look at other forms of treatment besides drugs that may or may not be needed? Or do you have any experience on this issue?
I agree with you on that. And there is a big effort to help educate everybody that, for the most part, these medicines that have been used have a success rate that is only about 25 or 30%, and anything that is used in the way of an antipsychotic or sedative should be very limited to a short period of time. If we were to really take a look at the medication regimens that people who have dementia issues or cognitive issues already, if we just looked at their medicines and reduced the list down, we could improve quality of life quite significantly. So, absolutely.
Her Honor and Robert, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
the Bob and Sandy Hyman Chair in Research and Education of Alzheimer's Disease and Medical Director of the Memory Disorders Center at the University of Cincinnati Neuroscience Institute, Dr. Rana Schatz, and Professor of Clinical Psychiatry and Director of the Cognitive Aging Program at the UC College of Medicine, Dr. Robert Krikorian. Coming up, how TV sitcoms have evolved through the years. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.